Good day to everyone. It's time to read the Ford Dodge Messenger from the editions of Friday, October 23rd and Saturday, October 24th. I'm Kevin Rogers here at the microphone. Glad to have you listening as always. Got a busy bunch of stories to get to, so let's go right to them. Family makes old farmhouse their own is the title of one story. From Dayton, while enjoying Christmas lights on a rural farm near Dayton on a date several years ago, a young couple admired the farm they were touring. At that time, they never imagined they would be living there, raising a family. Fast forward to 2016, when an opportunity arose for Gabe and Maddie Hewen to purchase the farm, and they took it. The farm, which is located in Burnside Township in Webster County, was originally homesteaded in 1892. By the Bergman family, who had immigrated from Sweden. They named their new farm Berries and Bees, as honey, raspberries, strawberries, and mulberries were produced and sold on the farm. They built a house at the time, as well as other outbuildings, including a large barn. In 1892 house later became a storage shed and was removed in the 1960s. The family built a much larger house in 1901. Throughout the generations, the home had remained in the family, making its way through the descendants of Bergmans to Rosenquist, who owned the farm prior to the Hewens. Gerald and Marcia Rosenquist bought the farm in 1962 and changed the name to Meadow Creek Farm. In 1969, a tornado destroyed all of the original buildings except for the two houses. The 1901 house had extensive damage and was literally cabled together to straighten it. During the next 6 years, Gerald and Marcia Rosenquist had the house raised for a new basement, and the house interior was completely gutted and remodeled. The couple later passed away in 2015, and their daughters sold the acreage to the Hewens. After the Hewens purchased the farm, they made it a working farm right away, fencing in their pasture and raising cattle, sheep, pigs, and bees. Currently, Gabe Hewen raises row crops and livestock and manages sites for Iowa Select Farms. Maddie is a speech-language pathologist, and together the couple is raising their daughter Lucy on their farm. The Hewens have been working to make the farm and farmhouse their own, with upkeeps and renovations made to help fit their tastes and needs. Along with an old farmhouse always comes a lot of work, but Maddie said she wouldn't trade it for anything. "You can make a farmhouse your own," she said. "Every nook and cranny has its own personality and its own character. It is the most peaceful place to be." From a creek that runs on the property and a small home decor business the couple operates together came the name Knack Creek Farm. Gabe and Maddie restore and create pieces from used items they find on their farm. "We're able to use old wood, restore it, and bring it back to life," said Maddie. Work continues on the farm. The Hewens plan to make updates to their farmhouse as needed, as well as keeping up on the repairs of their outbuildings. The couple also puts in a lot of time tending to the several gardens that feature perennials, trees, and shrubs that were originally planted by the Rosenquists. Some refer to farm life as living simple, but as we all know, there's nothing simple about farm life. There is always something to be done, said Maddie Hewen. Back to the main page of the Messenger website, Gateway to Discovery is going to hold a drive-through fundraiser coming up. Gateway to Discovery's Sweets fundraiser is making change this year as it adapts to the pandemic challenge. This year's fundraiser, a sweet treat drive-thru, will be held at Hope Sweet Hope Studios at 1900 Fifth Avenue South. For $20, patrons will receive a box of fulls of sweet handmade treats from local vendors. Those wishing to support the organization can stop by from noon to 5 on November 6th. And from 10 to 4 on November 8th, Gateway to Discovery's fundraiser will no longer be held at the Webster County Fairgrounds. In addition to the drive-through, the nonprofit will be holding 3 Facebook silent auctions with 3 separate rounds over the first 3 weeks of November. Raffle items this year will be available starting November 2nd at noon. That's a Monday. Raffle tickets can be purchased during studio hours and then any time for $5 until November 30th. Gateway to Discovery helps women struggling with addiction through a 2-year residency program. In addition to providing treatment, classes, and a safe living environment away from old social circles rife with substance abuse, the Gateway to Discovery program finds graduates with a humble stipend. Participants also help run the Hope Sweet Hope Studios shop. In exchange for agreeing to not go out to work, but instead devote their full attention to recovery, Each week, participants receive $25 and have another $15 socked away into a savings account they can access when they graduate. Modeled after a program in Tennessee, the savings account helps graduates get a fresh start in life as they move out of the group home to reestablish their lives. This year's proud graduates include three women with remarkable stories of hope on their successful journey away from addiction. Lily Weir, a 21-year-old college student, reclaimed her life through the program after breaking an addiction to methamphetamine that started at age 14. By successfully completing the program, she has found fulfillment that has helped her reclaim her childhood that meth robbed her of. Now she knows how to enjoy life without a chemical high. It took a few more tries for graduate Sarah Godinez, a 35-year-old mother, to get her life back on track. Gateway to Discovery was the last chance that stuck. She tried to get sober at least 15 times, starting when she was just 17. The child of meth addicts, Godinez turned to alcohol early on in lieu of drugs to avoid the same fate that tore her family apart. Her paternal grandfather and six of his seven brothers died of cirrhosis of the liver. Gateway to Discovery was the only program that would still take her, finally breaking the chain that tore her family apart for good. After losing everything by the time she was in her 40s, graduate Mary Wild also found unique success in Gateway to Discovery's faith-based program that worked for her, unlike other attempts through treatment programs. "I never knew how to have a life on life's terms. I knew I needed help," said Wild, "but I didn't know what kind of help I needed. I didn't necessarily know I had a drinking problem. I just didn't know how to live life." Now, with the sisterhood of emotional support bolstering sobriety's success, she couldn't imagine life any other way. If you go, the Gateway to Discovery fundraiser is entitled Sweet Treat Drive-Thru. It runs from noon to 5 on November 6th and from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on November 7th. And it will be at the Hope Sweet Hope Studios at 1900 Fifth Avenue South. A robber in a shooting has been sentenced to 25 years. There's no mandatory minimum set due to his age. A robber in a drug deal that left a man dead last October was sentenced to prison for a term potentially longer than he's been alive. Tabe Martinson, the juvenile who pleaded guilty to the first-degree robbery that preceded the October 2019 shooting in the 1400 block of A Street, was sentenced to an indeterminate term of up to 25 years in prison Thursday. The sentence handed down by District Court Judge Angelo Doyle came after a carefully weighed sentencing hearing that's required specifically for offenders who are juveniles at the time of their offenses. Due to his age at the time of the offense, Doyle did not impose a mandatory minimum that would normally be served prior to eligibility for parole. Martinson was 5 days shy of his 17th birthday when he went penniless into a robbery for a pound of marijuana behind Tom Thumb in October 2019. The one selling the pot, 28-year-old Mohammed Yaqub of South Dakota, was left dead in the car where the exchange happened. Martinson's co-defendant, Damian Chavez, is charged with first-degree murder in the shooting. After over 3 hours of testimony from a forensic psychologist and Martinson's family members, the weight of the sentence was delivered to an emotionally fraught courtroom gallery with more than 20 family members present in support of Martinson. Martinson pleaded guilty, but defense and state attorneys could not agree on a sentence to recommend to the court. First Assistant Webster County Attorney Ryan Baldridge recommended a 25-year prison sentence, including a 12.5 years mandatory sentence before being eligible for parole. "I understand his criminal history is not as advanced as other adults we've seen, but he sure started off strong," Baldridge said. "Had the defendant not entered into a scheme to commit the robbery, it's very likely the victim would still be alive here today." Martinson completed probation in March 2019 for another burglary he committed as a 15-year-old in 2017, in which he attempted to steal firearms and hundreds of rounds of ammunition from a Fort Dodge garage. Defense attorney Judd Parker asked for probation or deferred judgment, options Martinson would not have been eligible for had he been 1 year and 5 days older at the time of the offense, citing expert opinion that he could be rehabilitated at home and that he had already successfully completed probation once. If you give me one last chance, I promise I'll show everyone I can be a good person, Martinson said in his tearful address to the court after expressing regret that the victim was killed. Your Honor, please have mercy, he said. Martinson turned 18 almost a week ago. Hours-long testimony from forensic psychologist Dr. Louis Rozelle detailed an evaluation that the court used to evaluate how the mitigating factors of youth, impulsivity, impetuosity, or failure to appreciate the consequence of actions impacted Martinson's decision-making and his propensity for committing violent offenses in the future. The special sentencing procedures are based on more recently developed understandings that the prefrontal lobe of the brain, the last to be developed, is not formally formed until ages 21 to 25. The prefrontal lobe commands issues with attention, disinhibition, impulsivity, judgment, sequencing, and organization. Evaluations show that Martinson occasionally used marijuana and drank recreationally. He was high on ecstasy the night of the robbery, a first-time user. Martinson has lived with his maternal grandmother with his brother since age 2, as his parents experienced issues with substance abuse. Russell and the defense characterized Martinson's role in the robbery as that of a, quote, bystander who was coerced by peer pressure into the robbery. Doyle rebuked the characterization, citing language from his guilty plea that he went into the deal with, quote, knowledge and intention to commit the crime. Perhaps Russell's finding of secondary involvement is accurate as to involvement in the death, but certainly not accurate as to his involvement in the robbery, she said. He was not just a bystander, but he was an active participant. Character witnesses testifying in support of Martinson tried to persuade the court that he could be rehabilitated at home with family support, and that Martinson was capable of living a crime-free life when he was occupied by sports and school. Grandmother Lori Nelson said Martinson had goals in high school and played sports until last year. Did it keep him from doing bad things? Baldridge asked her. No, not really, she replied. The state is satisfied with the record made in court today regarding the defendant's sentencing, Baldridge said after the sentence was handed down. While we hope for a mandatory term of incarceration to guarantee the safety of our community, we are confident this ever-evolving area of law was adhered to as the sentence was handed down. Baldridge said the family of the victim was satisfied with the outcome and that the way the sentencing hearing was conducted should prevent any successful appeals. We are part way there to achieving justice for Mr. Yaquab's family, he said. Co-defendant Damian Chavez is scheduled to face trial for first-degree robbery and first-degree murder in 2021. Back to the main page of the Messenger, Webster County has been admitted to a new mental health region. Webster County was admitted to a new mental health and disability service region Wednesday, a move facilitated by new legislation allowing the county to divorce from county social services after years of reconciled tension. Webster County will join Central Iowa Community Services, currently located to the county's east and south, at the start of the next fiscal year on July 1st. Webster County Supervisor Mark Campbell announced the news with State Representative Ann Meyer, Republican from Fort Dodge, who spearheaded the legislation earlier this year allowing the change. It's been a long road and we're extremely excited, Campbell said, thanking Meyer. She stuck with us through the whole process. The new region already has a few new mental health services that Webster County has not had access to through CSS. In addition to more established services like a mental health mobile crisis response unit to help lead the way for similar fledgling services started recently in the county. I'm excited to know that we are going to be in a more functional region, Meyer said, reciprocating thanks to Campbell for his work on the issue. I'm looking forward to what the future brings with mental health services here in Fort Dodge. In addition to the ability to move or form their own mental health region, counties looking to leave CSS will also be allowed to take reserve funds with them, thanks to the new legislation. Under previous rules, Webster County would have lost $1.6 million in reserves used to tide the county over from year to year before taxes are paid. The policy changes were tacked onto a budget bill in June after some difficulty getting through similar changes through committee and subcommittee members who had concerns over transportation time in non-contiguous counties. CSS, the largest region in the state with 22 member counties, also presented similar challenges. Webster County officials have long complained of CSS neglect in delivering appropriate services and information to make decisions for the county. Blackhawk County is the largest funder of CSS. At $1.4 million annually, Webster County was the third largest funder of CSS. Many of Webster County's frustrations with CSS have boiled over publicly on more than one occasion, with county supervisors often expressing exasperation over an inability to get county-specific statistics showing how many residents are being served and the cost per resident. It's hard to pass legislation that just affects one part of the state, Meyer said. This legislation really was just affecting our region. No one liked to legislate for a small part, but when legislators saw the problem, that helped push it forward. Assuming no other counties join CICS, Webster County's addition will make the region just 12 counties large, including the following counties of Franklin, Hamilton, Hardin, Green, Boone, Story, Marshall, Jasper, Powashik, Madison, and Warren. The new legislation also allows the state legislature to audit a region. Back to the main page of the Messenger, and we'll see what's under the tack, the place of more news. The Fabric of a Family is the title of the next article. A grandfather and a grandson both received quilts of valor at the same time. Again from Duncombe, Richard J. McBride, a 95-year-old U.S. Marine Corps veteran, thought he was at the Duncombe Community Center on Wednesday night to see his grandson receive a quilt of valor. His grandson, Jacob J. McBride, a United States Army veteran of Webster City, thought he was there to see his grandfather receive a quilt of valor. In reality, the ladies of the American Legion Auxiliary No. 491 planned the event so both of them could receive quilts together on the same night. The grandfather thinks he's coming to see the grandson get one, said Joan Heisler, vice president of ALA No. 491, prior to the event. And the grandson thinks he's there to see his grandfather get one. They are both getting one, so it's really a surprise. The plan worked. I was surprised, said Jacob, who served as a sergeant in the Army after receiving the quilt. I did not see that coming. Mary Ellen Murphy, president of the ALA No. 491, said the group wanted to, quote, celebrate our veterans. A quilt is an expression of gratitude meant to thank you and comfort you, she said during the presentation. A quilt of valor unequivocally says thank you for your service and sacrifice. The quilts were sewn by Sally Payne of Duncombe. Cindy Kaufman, owner of Family Quilt Shop, did the quilting. Jacob McBride, an infantryman, earned two Purple Hearts during his service from 2010 to 2015. In September of 2013, he at one point questioned whether or not he would see his child again. I didn't get to see my firstborn child until she was 6 months old, he said. While at an observation post in Logar Province, Afghanistan, McBride's team began receiving gunfire from multiple insurgents. When one of his team's machine guns went down, McBride ran back for another one. I felt something hit my leg. I didn't know what it was. Then I felt something running down my leg, and I called for the medic. He added, with it being around the time my kid was born, I was thinking, who knows what could happen next? Am I going to see my kid again? McBride was honorably discharged in 2015. Reflecting on his time of service, McBride remembers his fellow soldiers. Knowing my friends had my back and we were able to make it out of there, it gave me a second family. The guys I served with in Afghanistan, I still talk to them all the time. We are still checking up on each other. A big honor to serve with those guys. Some of them are a part of the reason I'm still here today. In terms of his motivation for enlisting, McBride said his grandfather played a role. Growing up, he was my inspiration on why I wanted to serve, Jacob said. He was a big part of me joining the military. Richard McBride was a corporal on the Marines, serving from 1944 to 1946. He was profiled in the Messenger in 2018 and again in 2019. He enlisted at the age of 18 and transported goods and the wounded in the Battle of Peleliu during World War II. When the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan in August of 1945, McBride and the other Marines were loading ships for the planned invasion of Japan. They had no idea what an atomic bomb was. McBride was honorably discharged after 17 months with the Marines. He was awarded the World War II Victory Medal and the Asiatic Pacific Campaign Medal. Both Richard McBride and his grandson have been active in the American Legion. "We are proud of you," said Hislar as she presented the quilts. Jacob, who now works as a team manager for Van D's supply company, was appreciative of the support. "It's great," he said. "It shows that there's people out there who care about the veterans and do something for them for nothing." Going back to the main page of the Messenger as we scroll through the next article to the next article. J.C. Strong is the title of the next article and comes from Lake City. J.C. is spelled J-A-C-Y. "Why are there green mailboxes located around Calhoun County? Take a look at the name and 4-H logo on the boxes and the answer will become clear. The boxes are in honor of J.C. McAlexander," said Tiffany Blair, Calhoun County Youth Coordinator with Iowa State University Extension. "You can drop off pop tablet donations around Calhoun County to benefit the Ronald McDonald House in Des Moines. McAlexander was a Logan Larks 4-H Club member who served on the Calhoun County 4-H Council and State 4-H Council. Even after the Rockwell City native was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, a rare type of cancerous tumor that grows in the bones of the soft tissue around the bones, he never quit serving others. He became a National Honor Society member, achieved his dream to become an Eagle Scout, and attended the 4-H Congress in the fall of 2017 in Atlanta, Georgia, even as cancer weakened his body. On August 8, 2020, a small dedication ceremony was held at the Calhoun County Expo Center in Rockwell City to officially dedicate one of the three of J.C.'s mailboxes. The three mailboxes will be located at the Calhoun County Expo Center in Rockwell City, the west side of South Central Calhoun High School in Lake City, and Manson Northwest Webster High School in Manson. The public is welcome to collect pop tap can tabs, package them in zippered plastic bags, and deposit them in the mailboxes. Calhoun County 4-H Youth Council members clean out the mailboxes, sort the tabs, and prepare them to be donated each month. J.C. saw a need to give back to an organization that he was introduced to after his cancer diagnosis. He started the project of collecting tabs throughout his community so he could give back to the Ronald McDonald House. McAlexander had been diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma in second grade and had to undergo many rounds of chemotherapy. He never let cancer squelch his desire to learn. 4-H was such a big part of J.C.'s life, said his mother, Kiri, who was a Logan Larks 4-H club leader for 15 years, along with her husband, Earl. McAlexander embraced a wide range of 4-H projects, from photography and pets, he was a lifelong cat lover, to communication and citizenship. He even channeled his cancer journey into 4-H educational exhibits on radiation treatment. J.C. always set the bar high, said Kiri, who noted that many of his projects earned top honors at the Calhoun County Exposition and the Iowa State Fair. He believed that nothing less than his best was good enough. J.C. also embraced community service opportunities, including cancer research fundraisers. His Beat Cancer T-shirt project featured the purple, black, and white colors of the South Central Calhoun School District, as well as number 36. This reflects the fact that 36 kids are diagnosed with cancer every day, Kiri said. While selling these shirts helped raise a few hundred dollars for the Children's Cancer Connection, J.C. didn't stop there. As the captain of Team J.C., he raised nearly $12,000 for the American Cancer Society through a Relay for Life event in Calhoun County. His mission that drew the most attention, however, was the Pop Tab Collection Project to benefit the Ronald McDonald House and Charities of Central Iowa. J.C. was very goal-oriented, said his father, Earl, a Beaconsfield, Iowa native who grew up in the 4-H family and has served as a 4-H youth program specialist. After he reached his initial goal of collecting 1 million pop tabs, he decided to go for a ton. The dynamic teen also loved playing the trumpet in the South Central Calhoun High School band, jazz band, participating in FFA, competing in high school speech contests, and being part of the South Central Calhoun football team, wearing the number 19 jersey his freshman year and serving 2 years as the team's manager after the battle with cancer ended his athletic career. Early on, his doctor said, "We've learned you don't underestimate J.C.," said Earl. J.C. relished the opportunity to exhibit a steer at the 2015 Iowa State Fair during the Governor's Charity Steer Show. Since its inception in 1983, Governor's Charity Steer Show has generated more than $3.2 million, the equivalent to more than 270,000 night stays. in support of Iowa Ronald McDonald House chapters, according to the Iowa Beef Industry and the Iowa Cattlemen's Association. As he touched more lives with each new endeavor, JC's growing network of friends supported his goal to collect a ton of pop tabs to raise money for the Ronald McDonald House. "It took a truckload to hold JC's first goal of 1 million pop tabs," said Earl, who noted the family's garage and neighbor's garage were filled with buckets and boxes of pop tabs. "A ton of tabs was about twice that." Supporters continued to drop off bags of pop tabs at the Alexander home. As JC shared his story on the national level, in 2017 he served as a youth delegate who met with Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley in Washington, D.C., about increasing funding for childhood cancer research. The courageous teen drew on all his skills he had learned through 4-H, including public speaking, leadership, and teamwork. "Only 4% of funding for cancer research goes towards pediatric cancer," Carey said. JC spoke with Senator Grassley about the need for more funding for children's cancer research. Meanwhile, the pop tabs kept pouring in. JC was sick almost continuously the last 2.5 years of his life and dealt with intense pain during the last 6 months of his life. One time he said, "This is never going to end, is it?" But he never complained or asked, "Why me?" Instead, he focused on his pop tabs, which could be exchanged for money at a Des Moines recycling center. The project was personal, and since the McAlexander family had spent up to 7 weeks at a time at the Ronald McDonald House in Des Moines as their son received cancer treatments, even when tumors on his spine paralyzed him by the spring of 2018, JC never fought alone. He also reached his goal, collecting a ton of pop tabs. "His 4-H friends were there for him throughout all of this," said Carey, who added that 4-H members collected another 1,000 pounds of pop tabs at the 2018 State 4-H Conference. "It was such a gift to us that JC had such great friends and lived such a full life." Hours before he passed away on May 16, 2018, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home in Fort Dodge, JC granted an interview to Eric Hansen, a KCCI television reporter who shared the story of the pop tabs. When Hansen asked why this goal was worth pursuing, the 17-year-old's answer reflected the most profound influence of 4-H on his life. "It's worth it because it's a charity in our community," said JC, whose legacy lives on through the JC McAlexander Suite at the Ronald McDonald House in Des Moines, and through the thousands of pounds of pop tabs his family and friends have collected and have continued to collect since he passed away. "Citizenship is very important, and giving back is very important." Today, there's hardly a 4-H club around Iowa that hasn't heard of JC's story or hasn't worked in their own communities to collect tabs in his honor. Literally, tons of tabs have been collected and donated across Iowa. Iowa State Extension Calhoun County extends a special thanks to Shane Olson from Olson Iron Works for ordering the mailboxes, Jonathan McChesney for painting them green, and Olivia Hanlon for making the vinyl decals for the boxes, Blair added. Members of the Jackson Pioneers 4-H Club in Lake City are inspired to JC's legacy. "JC was a pretty special kid, was pretty special to my kids," said Brianne Tepley Melody, who helps lead the Jackson Pioneers 4-H Club. "His parents, Carrie and Earl, met in my hometown of Diagonal in southwest Iowa, where they both started working. JC's story reflects how 4-H'ers can use their skills for larger service," Blair said. "Little did JC or any of us know that this project would eventually grow into something that we can truly say has been for his club, his community, his country, and his world," she said. From our files today, features an article from October 2005 explaining the rules about yard waste disposal and how they may vary from town to town, no matter what the local ordinances might be. With regard to disposal of leaves, playing in them is legal wherever you go. And in this picture, Ross Halligan, then age 4, ducks as the leaves he's just tossed into the air come back down in the yard of his grandparents, Phil and Pat Halligan, in Moreland. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind, and now we will take a look at the obituaries. Donald Ulrich Jr. Don Ulrich passed away Tuesday, October 20th, surrounded by his family. He was 83. Don was born in Fort Dodge. He earned his bachelor's degree from Loras College in Dubuque. He is survived by his wife of 60 years, Sharon, two children, Tracy Smith, married to Scott, and Chris Ulrich, married to Kristen. He has six grandchildren, Spencer Carter and Parker Smith, and Ethan Morgan and Jordan Ulrich. Don spent 20 years in the Coca-Cola system in 1979. He joined the parent company in Atlanta as senior vice president and was responsible for USA bottlers and national sales. He acquired an interest in the Coca-Cola franchise for Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Later, after selling his franchise, he and Sharon returned to Phoenix in 1989. In 1993, he donated a year of his time to reorganize the agencies of the Arizona State Government, and also lectured at the Arizona State University Business School. He served on many boards over his lifetime, among them the Arizona Board of Regents, Arizona State University Foundation, Honor Health Hospitals, Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., Boys and Girls Hope National Board, U.S. Olympic Committee out of Arizona, Brophy Preparatory School, Heard Museum, Waste Not, National Art at Stabilization Board of New York, Food for the Hungry, Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., Kennedy Center for Performing Arts Society, Great Hearts Charter Schools, Coca-Cola Apartheid Committee, and the Franciscan School of Theology. Because of COVID-19, there will be a small private family service at the Franciscan Renewal Center. Later, a celebration of his life will be announced. Donations can be made to Arizona State University or Hospice of the Valley. Martha Jo Fisher. Martha Jo Fisher, 49, of Ogden, died Wednesday, October 21st at her home in Ogden. Graveside services will be at 9:30 on Wednesday, October 28th at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery at Adele. Visitation is from 5 to 7 Tuesday at the Carson Stapp Funeral Home in Ogden. Carson Stapp Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Martha Jo Gregory, daughter of Richard Gregory and Jacqueline Bear Gebel, was born October 24, 1970, in Webster City. She was raised in Webster City and graduated from Webster City Senior High in 1989. Throughout the years, Martha worked for Farm Journal and Beam Industries, both in Webster City, Neil Data in Clarion, Van Tech in Webster City, and most recently at Dollar General in Ogden. On January 13, 2016, Martha married John W. Fisher in Boone. The couple made their home in Ogden. Martha enjoyed crafts, playing cards with her family, motorcycle rides, and stock car races. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Patricia Pat Menke. Patricia Pat Menke, 71, died suddenly Tuesday, October 20th, at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Services will be 10 a.m. Saturday, October 31st at Gunderson Funeral Home. In cremation services, visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service from 9 to 10 Saturday, October 31st at Gunderson's. A full obituary is online at GundersonFuneralHome.com. The next obituary is for Janet Kramersmeyer. Visitation for Janet Kramersmeyer will be 4 to 7 Monday at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. Masks are mandatory. Please follow social distancing protocols. Family services will be held Tuesday. Faust Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Harlow Severs. Harlow Severs, 84, of Branson, formerly of Humboldt, died October 20th at Cox Hospital in Branson. Services will be 10:30 Monday, October 26th at Zion Lutheran Church in Humboldt. Burial will be at 2 o'clock at Morgan Township Cemetery near Schleswig. Military rites will be presented by U.S. Army Honor Guard. Visitation is 3 to 6 Sunday at Laufesweiler's Funeral Home in Fort Dodge. Harlow Severs was born on February 13, 1936 in Denison in the home of his grandparents, Emil and Rose Jakes, who raised him as a youth. He graduated from 8th grade at Zion Lutheran School in Denison and from Denison High School in 1954. In 1955, he entered the U.S. Army, serving in Korea and the Far East, After his honorable discharge in 1957, he enrolled at Morningside College in Sioux City. On November 23, 1958, he was united in marriage to the former Jolene Schultz at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Schleswig. After their marriage, they made their home in Sioux City and later moved to St. Paul, Minnesota. Harlow attended the University of Minnesota, graduating in 1960. After his graduation, they moved to Denison, where he served as an apprentice, his apprenticeship under Walter Hebner at Hebner Funeral Home. In 1962, they moved to Fort Dodge, where Harlow was employed by Loffesweiler Funeral Home. In 1964, he moved to Humboldt, where he established the Severs Funeral Home. He returned to Fort Dodge as manager of Loffesweiler Funeral Home from 1971 to 1974. In 1974, he moved to Humboldt as vice president of Crestpack Incorporated, now Liguria Foods. In 1975, he was named president and chairman of the board, a position he held until 1985 when the company was sold to John Morrell. It was during his tenure as president that he was awarded the Iowa Regional Businessman of the Year by the United States Small Business Administration. In 1987, he entered into a partnership with Joe Loffesweiler, and they operated several funeral homes in northwest Iowa. In 1998, he and Jolene retired and moved to Branson, where he continued to remain active in the business as a board member and consultant. He was a former member of the Iowa Funeral Directors Association and was awarded his 50-year pin in 2011. Harlow was a former member and officer of the Humboldt Fire Department, past member of the Humboldt City Council, and past president of the Humboldt Chamber of Commerce. While a member of Zion Lutheran Church, he served as chairman of the building committee when the church and educational unit was constructed. He was a former member of the board of directors of Bank Iowa and a member of the board of directors of High Capacity Engineering and Manufacturing. Harlow would like to let you all know his work here is done, and he's answered a call we all knew he'd receive. He was one to face obstacles with ease and take chances in life. One of the most dangerous of all, allowing his granddaughter to drive his golf cart at a mere 5 years old. He was a man of unwavering faith and commitment to family, and while his adventures and achievements in life could fill an epic novel, Gerald met the love of his life, Shirley Lang, in 1949 at Twin Lakes Skating Rink, and on July 10, 1955, they were united in marriage in Rockwell City. Gerald served in the Army National Guard Reserve from 53 to 66, earning the rank of Sergeant E5. In his younger years, Gerald worked at the Rockwell City Dairy and was manager of the Highway 66 service station, also in Rockwell City. He worked for the GTE Telephone Company, retiring in 1996 with 37 years of service. Gerald was active with various community groups, including the Manson Volunteer Fire Department, JC's, Kiwanis Lions Club, and Habitat for Humanity. He was always willing to lend a hand and help with any community project. He was also an active member of the Memorial Lutheran Church in Nevada, and in his spare time he enjoyed golf, gardening, fishing, hunting, car races, camping, and watching college football and basketball, especially the Iowa Hawkeyes. Gerald was especially known for his love of coffee time with family and friends and his gift of gab, and great sense of humor, also known as Jerryisms. Gerald especially loved to be with his family and watch his grandchildren and great-grandchildren grow up to be good citizens. Gerald is survived by his son, Dale, his daughters, Janet and Bruce Pohl, and Jill and Mike Brown, his sisters, Betty Lou Corder, Marjorie and Ronald Hepp, Mary Hines, and Linda and Alan Osterhout, 7 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, his wife, and an older brother, Dale. Services will be 11 o'clock Saturday, October 24th. They were held Saturday the 24th at Memorial Lutheran Church in Nevada. And services are available through the Rasmussen Ryan Funeral Home Facebook page if you care to see a recording. And they are located in Nevada. Memorials may be given to the choice of the donor. Craig A. Peterson, 66, of Dayton, died Tuesday, October 20th at the Israel Family Hospice House in Ames. A drive-through viewing will be held Saturday, October 24th. Cremation will follow the viewing. There will be a celebration of a life service held at 2 o'clock on Monday the 26th at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Dayton. At the request of the family, please wear a mask. Burial will follow at the Dayton Cemetery. Memorials may be left to Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Dayton. Craig's celebration of life will be live streamed on Carson's Depp Funeral Home Facebook page. Dennis E. Olson. Dennis E. Olson, 76, of Fort Dodge, formerly of Pocahontas, died Wednesday, October 21st at Mercy One in Des Moines. Services are 11 a.m. Saturday, or were held, rather, 11 a.m. Saturday at Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas. Burial was at the Calvary Cemetery in Pocahontas. Powers Funeral Home in Pocahontas was in charge of arrangements. The next notice is for Joanne Hoover. Joanne Hoover of Titanca died recently. A public visitation and service for Joanne Hoover of Titanca was held on Saturday, October 24th. Ruth E. Wagner. Ruth E. Wagner, 102, of Fort Dodge, died Tuesday, October 20th. A celebration of Ruth's life will be held at a later date. Loffesweiler Seavers Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And it looks like that is the extent of today's obituary page. Some breaking news has come into the Fort Dodge Messenger website. A Fort Dodge man is charged with attempted murder after allegedly cutting and stabbing a 71-year-old victim with a knife early Saturday morning, according to the Fort Dodge Police Department. Reno Bodaddy, 37, of Fort Dodge, is charged with attempted murder, a Class B felony. Officers were called to 504 North 3rd Street at 4:40 a.m. When they arrived, they located Bodaddy at the residence. Inside, they found a 71-year-old woman who had been cut and stabbed with a knife. The woman was transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center with serious but non-life-threatening injuries. Bodaddy is being held in the Webster County Jail. We'll take a look next at recent arrivals. From Iowa Specialty Hospital, Kelsey and Matt Andrews of Camrar welcome a girl, Maddie Mae Andrews, born October 14th. Grandparents are Renda and Kevin and Kimberly and Bruce. And that is the only arrival listed in today's newspaper. Got some birthdays to tell you about. Dick Ty. Dick Ty of Webster City will celebrate his 90th birthday on Sunday. His family includes Meredith and John Thomas, Paula and Dick Eddy, Connie and Bob Humble, Richard Leslie Ty, Jim and Sherry Ty, Maggie and Mark Shanka. He has 36 grandchildren, 31 great-grandchildren, 4 step-grandchildren, and 1 step-great-grandchild. Dick Ty was born October 25th, 1930 in Omaha, Nebraska. He is a retired football coach and teacher of 63 years. He served in the Army from 1952. To 1954, he married his first wife, Margot Daly, in Sioux City on April 27, 1953. She passed away in 2012. He married Wynn Ann Allen of Eagle Grove on December 13, 2014. Roland Harklaw, age 90, of Sac City, will celebrate his 90th birthday, rather, on Wednesday, aged almost 90. His family includes David and Darla Harklaw and Denise and Dan O'Mara. He has 3 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren. His wife, Carol, is deceased. He was born October 28, 1930, in rural Calhoun County and graduated from Summers High School in 1949. He enlisted in the United States Air Force in 1950, served in the Korean War, and served 1 year in Korea. He was married on June 19, 1955. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Iowa State Teachers College and a Master's degree from the University of South Dakota. He retired from teaching and coaching in 1992. Ann and Tony Marino. Ann and Tony Marino for Dodge will celebrate their 40th wedding anniversary Sunday. Ann Becker and Tony Marino were married October 25th, 1980. And it looks like that's all the birthdays and wedding anniversaries for today. Today's Messenger editorial is an endorsement of Ann Meyer for House District 9. The Messenger editorial headline, Representative Ann Meyer deserves another term in office. In her first term, State Representative Ann Meyer has proven to be a hardworking, thoughtful, and independent lawmaker. That's why the Republican from Fort Dodge should be reelected to serve House District 9 in the Iowa legislature. With health care and especially mental health care a pressing concern for the state, Meyer is uniquely qualified to play a key role in writing laws to address such issues thanks to her more than 30 years as a nurse and nursing instructor. To improve mental health care close to home, Meyer wrote a measure that enabled Webster County to join a new regional organization while holding on to $1.6 million in reserve funds. During her first term in office, she did not limit herself to health care issues. She authored legislation to make child care more available, motivated by a constituent story of being run off the road by a driver using a cell phone. She wrote a bill that would require all electronic devices to be in hands-free mode while being used by someone behind the wheel. Because COVID-19 cut the 2020 legislative session short, these bills did not become law. But if Meyer is reelected, she'll be bringing these common sense measures that would benefit all Iowans back to the Iowa House of Representatives. We're certain she will introduce even more good bills during a second term in office. Meyer has a track record of going to bat for her constituents. When someone contacts her to seek help with a problem they've encountered dealing with state agencies, Meyer generally replies to them within a couple of hours to say she received their message and is looking into the matter. Sometimes she'll have an answer or a resolution a few hours later. She isn't afraid to go against her party's leadership when she believes it necessary to do so. Her independent nature was demonstrated in 2019 when the Republican leadership was pushing a plan to change the way Iowa judges and Supreme Court justices are chosen. Meyer didn't think the plan was a good idea and declined to go along with it. Her stand helped lead the way to a compromise which became law. To win another term, Meyer must defeat Democrat Charles Clayton, a man with a long record of helping youth in the community. We respect Clayton, but remain convinced that Meyer is the better choice. The Messenger endorses State Representative Ann Meyer for a second term and urges voters to send her back to the state capitol. Letter to the editor. To the editor. This year, 2020, has brought several changes to everyone's life. One aspect, that comes to my mind in law enforcement. I've been a member or part of it for 33 years. This is one of the most memorable in my time and a very important year for our local law enforcement. We have two candidates for the position of Webster County Sheriff. They both have been in law enforcement for a number of years. I personally worked hand in hand with both. My choice for Webster County Sheriff, hands down, is Tony Walter. He is much younger, which we need today in the world. He brought the canine unit to the Sheriff's Department from the ground up. He has led that area with expertise and the willingness to help at any given moment. Walter has the new generation drive, which, in my opinion, will bring the Sheriff's Department into the 21st century. This new way of thinking for law enforcement is what's going to drive a department to open and expand their abilities. Walter is open to these concepts, to these new concepts in community policing. With Walter at the helm, I believe he will bring new insights to the Webster County jail staff, which is in need. This is one of the major concerns as far as the new sheriff is elected. With all the turnover, younger employees, this is where his new age thinking will take the staff of the jail to the next level. It's going to take a sheriff who knows the needs of a younger generation to make this area of his staffing to the new way of law enforcement. Walter has the patience and knowledge that will bring this part of his staff to one which will be admired as one of the future leaders in jail administration and incarceration. In regards to training, Walter is looking at all areas of law enforcement, not just one specific area. Walter is also looking at ways for our whole county to train and save costs to the taxpayers. With the right people, these goals can be accomplished with the sheriff's staff well-trained and ready to serve the citizens. With Walter, the sheriff's departments can and will The sheriff's department can and will move into the future with great professionalism and always promoting great law enforcement. His personality and knowledge brings the new era officer with efficiency and proficient community policing with an open door aspect to the citizens of Webster County. He will add many more years of consistent law enforcement to the Webster County. He is much younger than his opponent and has no plans to retire or move after one term. For that reason, the department will run for years with one consistent leader who will lead by example and always open to new ideas for training, staffing, and working with community leaders to bring a great department to Webster County. My vote will be for Tony Walter for Sheriff of Webster County on November 3rd, 2020. And that was submitted by Dennis P. Murka of Fort Dodge. We'll take a look next at some sports highlights. We talked a little bit the other day about how the St. Edmund Gales cross country teams had won their districts in cross country and have both qualified for state. I can tell you that West Waterloo defeated the Fort Dodge Dodgers in football Friday night with a score of 24-17, ending the Dodgers' season. Nick Moser felt helpless after Fort Dodge's crushing 24-17 Class 4A second-round postseason loss to Waterloo West on Friday at Memorial Stadium. Helpless because he couldn't do anything about the outcome. Helpless because a pair of questionable officiating decisions late, one call and one no-call, stalled the Dodgers' potential tying or even winning drive in a goal-to-goal situation during the final minute of the game. And helpless because he had to face a locker room full of teary-eyed, crestfallen players who had just watched their season come to an end in devastating fashion. "I'm at a loss for words," said Mosier, who saw his inaugural year at the helm finish in a way that left him perturbed. "Our guys fought back after a tough third quarter with heart and guts. We made plenty of mistakes. I made plenty of mistakes. It's just an awful feeling. Leaves a sick taste in your mouth, wondering what might have been. This isn't the way any of us envisioned it ending. I wish I could say or do something to change the outcome. I'd do it in a second, but that's the way it goes sometimes. You have to accept it and move on." Trailing by a touchdown with 4:40 to go, Fort Dodge, 3-5 for the season overall, marched from its own 9-yard line to the Wahawk 8. Senior Tyler Schreier appeared to have scored what could have been the tying or even go-ahead touchdown on a second-and-goal sprint to the end zone, but the Dodgers were whistled for holding, their first such infraction of the night. Instead of either kicking the extra point or going for a two-point conversion in the win in the waning seconds, Fort Dodge was backed up to the West 22-yard line. Two plays later, with the season on the line, junior quarterback Carson Peterson lofted a pass for sophomore Javian Jondo in the back of the end zone. There was definite contact between Jondo and the defensive back as the ball soared toward the Dodger receiver, but no flag was thrown for pass interference. The Wahawks 4-4 overall took over on downs and drained the final minute of the clock to prevail. Mosier was demonstrative in challenging the final ruling on the fourth down pass attempt, but his pleading fell on deaf ears and the possession exchanged hands for good. "I'm incredibly disappointed in what happened there in the final result," said Mosier, still visibly upset. "Our kids fought too hard to have that sequence of events go down the way it did. There's nothing we could do about it, though. The calls were made or weren't made, and that's it." West trailed 10-3 at halftime, but the Wahawks had run 48 plays from the scrimmage to the Dodgers' 22 at that point, and the tide began to turn in the third period. A 15-play, 65-yard touchdown drive to the start of the quarter knotted the score and wore Fort Dodge Senior High's defense down even more. "We couldn't get our defense off the field," said Mosher. "They were bending but not breaking in that first half. It was a huge credit to our guys that we'd only given up 3 points, but they converted a number of third downs to start the second half, four on that drive alone, and just kind of chipped away at us until we finally gave in." A 50-yard screen pass for a score late in the third period put the Wahawks up 17-10, and a back-breaking sequence early in the fourth knocked the Dodgers' backs against the wall. West intercepted a pass in the red zone to thwart a successful Fort Dodge answer, and on the next snap, senior quarterback Carter Schulte threw a 64-yard touchdown strike to standout receiver Tay Norman. Instead of a potential tie score, the Dodgers were suddenly down 24-10. Fort Dodge regained some momentum with a 54-yard touchdown pass from Peterson to Schreier, and then forced a punt to set up the final possession. Senior Deason Clayton was capping his brilliant four-year varsity career with a 23-carry, 154-yard performance. Seeing the field for the first time in a month at or near full strength, he accumulated 59 of his yards on the final drive before suffering an injury and having to leave the contest. He ended up with 3,481 rushing yards, third all-time behind Sam Cook and his older brother, John Tell. In the forecast, we are under a winter weather advisory for the Fort Dodge area for Sunday, expecting 2 to 4 inches of snow. Bad news is we're still supposed to get snow, but the good news is it was going to be 4 to 6, and now they've backed it down a little bit. High of 31 on Sunday, high of 28 on Monday, high of 31 on Tuesday. Warming up into the mid to upper 40s Wednesday and Thursday through Friday. Friday and Saturday have highs in the 40s and 50s under sunny skies, which is good because state cross-country meet is in town those 2 days. Sounds like a perfect day or a couple of days for running. Sunny on Sunday, 48 degrees, followed by another high of 48 on Monday. Temperatures at night mostly in the mid to upper 20s to lower 30s. And so our time together is concluded for the day. You have been listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, October 23rd and Saturday, October 24th. I'm Kevin Rogers, your reader, and of course these recordings are available at the iowaradioreading.org website, and you're listening to Iris. Folks, take care, and we'll talk to you again real soon.